and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tinellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax.
This episode is brought to you by HarperCollins Publishers Australia.
Robin Cadwallader is an award-winning Canberra-based author with three historical novels to her name, along with poems, prize-winning short stories, and a non-fiction book based on her PhD thesis about virginity and female agency in the Middle Ages. Robin's first novel, The Anchoress, was published in 2015 to critical acclaim and was awarded the Canberra Critics Circle Award for Fiction and the ACT Book of the Year People's Choice Award. Her second novel, Book of Colours, followed in 2018, winning the 2019 ACT Book of the Year Award, along with another Canberra Critics Circle Award, and it was shortlisted for a Voss Award. In early May, Robin's third novel, The Fire and the Rose, will be released by HarperCollins. And listeners, what a book this one is. A deeply moving, mesmerising and timeless story about forbidden love. A story about the power of words and a woman's fight to be with the man she loves, going against her church, against the law, and against her king. A novel that explores prejudice and racism along with faith, this book left a deep and lasting impression on me. And so it is with great delight that I welcome Robin to the podcast to chat about her marvellous new book with me today. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Claudine. Thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure. Before we started recording, I was gushing about how much I was moved by this book and how wonderful I found it to be, and wow is all I can really say. What a novel. So rich and multifaceted, the exquisite detail you've managed to embed into this fascinating tale is simply breathtaking. So firstly, I wanted to say congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. That's so lovely.
And secondly, I wanted to say, how long was this story in the making?
5 years in total. I began researching almost as soon as I'd finished Book of Colours and, you know, went off to the printers. I had a few ideas before that, but the proper research began in 2018. So it's coming up 5 years, it will be, since Book of Colours. So, yeah, a fair bit of research and lots of editing, two field trips to Lincoln, which was lots of fun, lots of thinking, lots of researching.
I can only imagine, because I felt it to be such an intensely research-heavy novel. You know, there was just so much rich detail in this book that clearly is reflected in the story and the period of time that you've managed to bring alive on the page. I mentioned your PhD in my introduction, so I wanted to know, did you begin writing your novels before or after completing that?
After that, I had always wanted to write, and my teachers encouraged me in high school, but I went to uni, and in those days there were no creative writing classes. So I studied all the greats at uni, English Lit, and just thought, who am I to even think about writing? So I kind of put that on the back burner a bit. Then I had four kids reasonably close, so that really took up nearly all my time, though I do see authors who manage to write with children. But I was full on mum, and then I started writing poetry and tinkered around. I wrote a journal for a long time, which was very important to part of my writing development, I think, sort of just writing and thinking about myself. And that led to poetry, and joined a few writing groups. I had a few poems published now and then. And it was when I entered a competition in Adelaide, the Friendly Street Poetry Group, and there was a competition for a single poet award. And if you won that award, you would get a poetry book published. A couple of friends and my husband really encouraged me to enter, and I was thinking, I don't know. But I entered and then nearly fell over when I won it. Honestly, I just had no expectation of winning. But that I think made me think, well, perhaps I could do this. And that was just around the time I was writing my PhD, finishing off my PhD. And because the PhD included some reference to anchoresses and I had done research on anchoresses, I began to think, oh, this would be such a fascinating story. Though I, like most people who hear about that it's about a woman in a cell, I wondered, can I build a story out of a woman in a cell? And a friend said to me, well, character is, stories are about character, aren't they? And the more I thought about that, and I actually went to England and visited a few anchor holds, sat in one, and it was there that my character started to come to life. So I started writing. That was after the PhD. I have to say I didn't enjoy doing the PhD. I enjoyed the research, but I found the writing very difficult. And lots of people, you know, say it's the hardest thing to do. I think what it did do is give me a sense of being able to write at length, to manage a large project. My thesis was about 110,000. So that's pretty much the size of the novels I write. So I think it was a training, even though it wasn't. Well, it was creative as well. I think why I chafed so much was that I wanted to do something creative. And my supervisor kept saying, you have to get the argument right. And I didn't want to write an argument. I wanted to write something else kind of with dimension and not just this straight line of an argument. So that was where that the real itch came. I'm not going to die wondering. I'm going to have a go at writing a novel. So yeah. That was the anchoress, came after the PhD. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. And so, yeah, to be clear, the anchoress was a novel steeped in the Middle Ages. And so what was it about medieval times that you were interested in writing about?
I have always loved medieval literature because I think they had such a strong, gutsy sense of language, and I love the sound of words. I was always drawn to their kind of take on life, but I hadn't thought about writing about them until I came across The Anchoress. I am interested in writing historical fiction. I'm interested in how people make sense of the world that they're in. So I'm not interested in kings and queens, though I am interested in power structures, but I'm not interested in, you know, what the queen happened to be wearing that day. I'm interested in how they shape their lives, how women particularly deal with the kind of structures that limit them.
Yes. Yeah, so The Anchoress came out in 2015, and now here we are in 2023 with The Fire and the Rose. And I feel like this story is kind of picked up not long after the events of The Anchoress, even though I haven't actually read The Anchoress. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about your inspiration for writing The Fire and the Rose.
I read about the expulsion of the Jews in doing some research for the other two novels. And I went back and reread because I was horrified at this thought of a group of people just being told to leave a country. At the time, I couldn't do more research, but that never left me. That sense of horror that people who have lived among people, settled in a country, been part of a community, could be simply told to go. So that was the first part of my inspiration. And the other was that in The Anchoress, there's a little girl, Eleanor, who learns to write because she bothers the anchoress and asks lots of questions, and the anchoress teaches her letters for the first time. And she was she kind of just came into that novel. And I have always wondered, what would it be like to be a little girl in a village, a small English village, where most people can't read or write, having that capacity and being a sort of curious, pushy sort of kid? How would she get on? And so eventually those two things came together as I was thinking about the Jews and thinking about Eleanor's later life.
As I said, it was an absolutely mesmerizing story. But for those who haven't read it yet, Robin, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the story.
Well, the story is about Eleanor. Essentially, she leaves her home village under some fairly difficult circumstances. She moves to Lincoln as a housemaid. That's the only work she can get, but she is determined to become a scribe because she has these skills. She loves words, loves being able to write. So she's determined. that she will become a scribe and that she will remain independent. She doesn't want to commit herself emotionally to other people because of her past, some pain from the past. As a housemaid, she has to go and visit a spicer, and he's a Jew. She doesn't know much about Jews, but she's been told that they're, you know, you need to stay away from Jews. They're strange people. So she meets this spicer and is a bit taken aback that she is quite drawn to him. And Eleanor has a burned psalter, a psalter that's been burned in a house fire. That's, if you've read the Anchoress, you might remember the psalter. And she mentions that to Asher, the Jew, that she has a book of Psalms, and he is very interested. And Psalms are the one point of the Bible that really connects Jews and Christians, that Christians recite Psalms in church and Jews recite Psalms in their ceremonies. So Eleanor finds herself showing him this book, which she has shown very few people. And a relationship develops, and she realizes that it's too dangerous to continue, but she does. Eventually, she inevitably becomes pregnant and is then forced to try and manage on her own, and has to accept the help of a Jewish woman called Markotta. And she raises this child by herself.
The events of The Fire and the Rose span some 14 years. And as you've alluded to, there's much political and societal upheaval in the English cathedral city of Lincoln, which is an actual place. Why did you decide to set the novel there?
Well, Lincoln had the second largest population of Jews in England around the time that I was writing. So I was initially interested in Lincoln, and I went to visit there. And it is quite an astonishing city because it's stone. The houses, the old part of the city is castle, cathedral, ruins, stone streets, stone houses. And some of them that do date back to the 13th century. There is a house there called Jew's House. It's not quite clear whether that was a Jewish synagogue. And it has a very steep hill. It's built on a very steep hill. And all of that just felt to me like it could become a character in a novel. It felt the perfect place to set a novel. So I knew that I would have plenty of Jewish characters in Lincoln who would have a significant part to play in the city because of their money lending.
Talking about the stone that is so obviously pervasive in Lincoln, I found it so utterly fascinating that there were two points of view in the novel. So we have Eleanor, who's telling her story, but we also have these other points of view that are interspersed throughout the novel, written from the point of view of the stone walls or the stones.
Yeah.
Tell me about that, and tell me about your decision to structure the novel this way.
Well, it was because I have a fascination with stone, and in England, when you go there, you know, there are standing stones, there are old buildings, there are gargoyles on old cathedrals. There's stone in all sorts of places, and I've often sort of felt that stone has a kind of life. It's not a sort of dead, dense object. It has a kind of life and a history to it. When I was in Lincoln, I really felt that the stone had a presence, and so I wanted the stone to be able to speak. I felt that the walls would be a kind of witness to what went on in the city, particularly, you know, all the attacks on the Jews. And I wanted the walls to be timeless. It took me a little while to get the sense of their voice, to move away from a kind of medieval voice to being a timeless witness. They have been there since the Romans, and they have lived through the centuries, and they have seen what has happened. And we use stone now to memorialize, you know, people, events. We think of our buildings, even like our war memorial is stone that is remembering what has happened. So I wanted the walls to help draw this story just out of being something that happened so many centuries ago in one place, and it's finished. I wanted the walls to become a kind of timeless witness and to say, to show how this event is relevant now. It has that timeless quality that you mentioned.
Eleanor was an incredibly well-drawn character, I felt. You mentioned her desire for independence, and she also had, as you mentioned, skills that were not usual for a woman of her time, her ability to read and write. But more importantly, I felt that despite the many limitations on women at the time, Eleanor had agency. She had more agency than I would have credited for women at the time. Tell me about your inspiration for Eleanor.
Eleanor, the little girl, was the initial inspiration. And in terms of agency, it's so interesting in the Middle Ages that often it was the people of lower classes who had some agency. Women had some agency because women of the upper classes were required to be married to certain people, and they didn't really have much choice in those kinds of, you know, what would happen to their lives. But for working women, there was a chance to develop some agency. For Eleanor, it's interesting that her desire to write and to become a scribe, her chances were pretty slim. But ironically, it's because so many people are arrested and imprisoned that she has an opportunity to become a scribe. I mean, she pesters the stationer. He says, no, you can't be a scribe and we need men as scribes. But she pesters him. She keeps going back. She wants him to know what she can do. She shows him what she can do. And it's when he finds that his usual scribes are either imprisoned or dead that she gets an opportunity. So it's the king's attack on his own people, really, that gives her the opportunity. But would never have happened without her kind of dogged determination. And her, she's an interesting mix because she's very proud of her abilities, almost too proud now and then, gets herself into strife. And that's the kind of person that she is. She's a bit impetuous and sometimes her own worst enemy. She's very loving and kind and very full of energy, but there are times when she oversteps the mark, but she acknowledges it and tries to learn again. And I really like that about her.
I loved her desire to stay independent, despite the fact that society continued to frown on her. She was an unmarried mother, so she sought the work because she needed the work. But, you know, I think there were pressures from society to say, well, you know, men need that work and that she should be doing her part by becoming married and, you know, giving her child a father. But she resisted all of that temptation. And I found that really quite remarkable for a character at that time.
Yeah. And I think because women were so controlled by men, there's an issue in writing historical fiction about women. I remember Hilary Mantel saying, you either write about a woman who, the problem with writing about women in the Middle Ages is that if you want to give them some kind of agency, you become anachronistic. Or if you try to write them in as they would have been in the period, you just reinforce that sense of women being controlled. Now, you know, who am I to disagree with Hilary Mantel? But, but I do, because I think that women, I can't believe that women didn't have a sense of what was possible for them to do. And I explore that in my second book of Colours, where a woman wants to become an illuminator, and she can do the work, but she's not being recognised. And often that was the case. Women worked alongside men and did the work, but couldn't join the guilds, were never recognised. It was only the men that were recognised. The women stayed behind, did the work. The men went out and did the buying and selling of their product. So I think that we need to be a bit careful in Hilary Mantel's version that we don't just assume that because they were controlled, they had no sense of their own abilities and their own capacities to do more than they did and to be recognised for what they did. And I think because Eleanor was encouraged as a child by the anchoress, but also by a couple of monks who lived nearby who also taught her, she has a sense of her own abilities. And I think we do a disservice to women if we just assume that the women were controlled, therefore they didn't have some spirit and some desire to do more than they were given. I'm sure that lots of women would have that sense that, well, they just needed to do what they were told. But I think it's unfair to assume that they wouldn't have had some agency and some desire. I think where the problem comes, the anachronism comes, is if we give them the power to overcome everything. And I think what Eleanor does is she works within the limits of the time, but she still does the work that she wants to do. You know, it's not an easy road for her. It's not as if she decides to become a scribe and so she does. I mean, she's one stationer that she speaks to says that she's like a monkey with a quill. So it's not an easy path for her.
No, it isn't. And she's met with a lot of suspicion, isn't she? I mean, you know, not everybody is really keen on her, on the idea of her working
for
the stationer and being a scribe, because as we mentioned, this was a job that men did. But as you say, you know, the fact that many of the people who were doing that job had been imprisoned or killed, there was an opening for her, not unlike what happened in the Great Wars, you know, for women who stepped up to do jobs that men had, you know, had always traditionally done. And suddenly there was these opportunities for women to do this work, and many women stepped up to do it. But in this case, Eleanor was the only one equipped to step up and become a scribe.
Yes. Yes, and there are those that either abused her for it or chose to use it.
I felt that you explored prejudice, racism, and sexism with such finesse in this book. The heinous attitudes towards the Jewish community, along with the attitudes towards women in general, especially someone like Eleanor, was breathtaking. I wondered, what resources did you turn to in order to bring this historical period alive on the page?
Well, I had done a lot of research because I had done the research for my PhD and then the next two novels. So I had a fair sense of the beliefs of the period and some of the structures of the period. I also did quite a bit of reading around racism. In particular, there's part of the story is the actual event of the creation of little St. Hugh, the boy who goes missing, and when he's found, Jews are accused of having killed him. That story actually happened, not that the Jews killed him, but his crypt is in the cathedral. And until recently, the Jews were blamed for his death, and it's only recently that the cathedral has apologized for having continued to blame the Jews for something that there was no evidence for. So I did quite a bit of reading around that area, particularly because that really focuses the extent of prejudice, I think, the ways in which prejudice operates in kind of, well, it's not particularly subtle, but it isn't simply telling people they can't do things. It's the power to create stories that demonize and build prejudice against people. There's quite a bit of theoretical academic work around that and around racism, the development of racism in the Middle Ages, particularly around the Jews. Yeah, and the sexism, I think I had a fair sense of that because of having done the research for the PhD and the novels.
Eleanor's bravery was something I admired above all of her other qualities. She chose love over her fear for what might happen to her if her relationship with Asher was to become widely known. She defied all the obstacles to continue to love him. And her love for him was stronger than the rules that forbade it. Tell me about that and why this is something you wanted to explore in the context of this novel.
Now, that's a question I haven't quite thought about. To be honest, I didn't know what was going to happen. I knew that she would fall in love with Asher. And as I wrote it, I had a very strong sense of physical attraction, a physical attraction that initially really overrode everything else, all her sense of what was the sensible thing to do and, you know, the commitment that she had made to keep herself safe and not commit to anyone. And at first she thinks that that's possible to do that, that she might be able to just have sex with this man and be like the animals, just have sex and then, but not feel very much. But the attraction deepens and the love deepens. I kind of let her character develop as I wrote, as things happened. So I knew that I would have several historical events that would occur, but I didn't plan what Eleanor's response to those events would be and the consequences of those events, so that Ash is taken to prison and she has to deal with that. And she, I think, is herself a little surprised at the depth of her love for him, that she really recognises once she realises she might never see him again. This probably isn't answering your question very well, but she really did develop as the action, and she responded as the action developed. I didn't set out thinking, well, I knew that she would be determined, but I didn't have I didn't think ahead about how brave she would be, how prepared she would be to risk virtually everything for Asher.
Did you ever think that this wasn't wise, that a woman of her time wouldn't choose to do what she did?
No, I didn't actually, because I imagine women are the same. Women, well, people are the same at all times. And a depth of love like that, despite, you know, not being able to be together and often not seeing each other for a length of time, that kind of love is universal. So I don't think it's a matter of whether it was the Middle Ages or not. I mean, certainly there's a chance that she could have decided that it was too dangerous. But when she has a little girl to deal with, she has to protect her daughter. So she's much more careful and is, in that sense, prepared to go on loving Asher but not seeing him very much, which is painful, but she's prepared to do it. So what begins as a kind of a real physical attraction develops into something that is, I think, very deep and very honest and very real. She struggles, but they go up and down, and it's a kind of relationship that I think is pretty common, in the sense that arguments happen, they go in and out of thinking, will they be together, won't they be together, is it all too hard? But there is something else that carries them through it all.
They really struggle. And I think this is what I found so deeply moving about this story, is that both of them really struggle. They struggle, you know, with their loyalties, with their ideologies, with their faith. Mm. But above all, they acknowledge that they do love one another very, very much. And I thought that was just so beautiful.
I won't give away too much by telling people about the scene, but there was one scene that I wrote, and it developed the way it developed, and I thought, oh no, I don't want that to happen. But it felt absolutely right that it did. There were a couple of times like that, and there were times where I typed and cried, but the story felt that it needed to go the way it needed to go. Even editing, I would come back and cry at various scenes, even though I must have read them about 50 times. Maybe I was having a tired day, but yeah, there were times when I still cried.
And listeners will need to read the book in order to understand exactly what we're referring to. Robin, if there was one thing you'd like readers to take away from this novel, what would it be?
Oh, that's a bit hard. I think I would really like to know that people were moved. I would really like people to recognize the dangers of demonizing difference, that so much flows from making someone into the other. The difference is something that offers so much to us, and demonizing others just shuts it down. So in that sense, I would like people to recognize the horror of that situation and to give it its due recognition, but also to recognize that flows on and is relevant for us today. Very relevant. Demonizing refugees, asylum seekers, people who have different colored skin. I mean, we're talking about that in the football at the moment with First Nations people being abused. So yeah, if I could contribute a little bit to that conversation, that would be wonderful.
You might know that there are many aspiring authors who listen to this podcast, and so I wondered, did you have any tips to offer about writing or the publishing process?
My tips about writing would be back yourself, write what you want to write, take risks. Don't shut yourself down before you've got going. So write what you want to write and follow that lead. I think all writers need to recognize the value of writing for its own sake. If we all just rely on being published in order to make our writing worthwhile, then we're in trouble. So I think we need to love writing for what it gives us. For me, writing helps me understand what I think and feel. And that process, the exciting process of telling a story, is the really important part of it. I can't deny that having it published and having other readers read it is wonderful, and having people respond is just wonderful. But yeah, and you just do need to keep trying. And I also think be involved with the writing community, find support, find a group that can help support you, and be aware of the larger literary community. I think social media, that's one of the gems of social media, is that the writing community on social media is so positive and so supportive. And that gives you, even though writing is a solitary kind of occupation, that gives you a very big community and a very lovely supportive community. So I think that's important too. But most of all, keep doing it and read as well. Read, 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 read. Lots.
Thank you so much. That's wonderful advice. So many gems in there. Robin, if listeners wanted to learn more about you and your books, where can they find you?
I have a website which is, as we speak, being transferred from one, or whatever you call them,
Hosting platform.
to another. I'm hoping it's still accessible. Just type in Robin Cadwallader and it should come up as a www.robincadwallader.com. They can find out about me there mostly.
And social media accounts.
Absolutely. I'm on Facebook. I have an author page and a private page. I'm on Instagram and I'm on Twitter. And in none of them do I have any interesting handles. It's just Robin. I think Twitter is Robin Cad, but Instagram is Robin Cadwallader. And always happy to have more friends. People would like to follow me up. Yeah, for sure.
Robin, it was such a joy for me to discover your writing in The Fire and the Rose. I absolutely loved it, and I'm looking forward to delving into some of your other work. I wish you every success with this book, and thank you for joining me on Talking Aussie Books today.
Thank you so much. I've had such a lovely time talking about it and wonderful questions. So thank you.
That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetonellis.com, via Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading!